and the person, first person, holds the end of the twine, tosses the ball, and the next person debriefs the class on how they can make the connection, and so on among all the students. And in this way, all the terms are debriefed in the 50-minute period. Everybody gets to talk. They actually are prepared. I don't know if it goes into their long-term memory. It's a great icebreaker. So that's the first thing we do with the silver, the second thing now. We've linked this activity to the lecture. Okay, now comes the fun, the batiking and mordants. And I'm waiting for this to come up, but let's see. There should be a yellow bar. And it didn't come up. Let me tell you what it said. It said, I have to go over lab safety with them because they're dealing with hot water and burners. All right, and cochineal, which can cause irritation to the hands, so they use gloves. Some of the equipment, then, we give them a little introduction to materials and methods and lab safety. The equipment they're using is shown here, and these are Jant tools. I can tell you how to get these if you're interested. And they're going to do batiking. Here's beeswax that's going to be melted in potpourri pots. Much of this comes from the Goodwill, except for the Jant tools. Here's a student actually using the Jant tools. It allows you to apply the wax in a neat way. They're like a little pipe with a spigot on the bottom. And so here's a student batiking. And then we use mordants. Mordants are chemicals. You see four of them listed here that we've experimented with in the lab that allows you to change the fabric of the silk in a way that permanently alters it so that when you come in with the cochineal dye, you end up getting different colors and different hues, and I'll show you what those look like here. These are swatches where students either have experimented with them to see different concentrations, so there's some empirical work involved on their part, weighing out the mordants, weighing out the cochineal in the next lab, and experimenting with concentrations and dye times and times in the mordant. And you can see go Cougs, because you know that's who we are. Okay, so that's the first lab. They've gotten the scarves ready to receive the cochineal. Then they come into class the next week, and I give them a lecture again, try to be interactive, unlike what I'm doing with you so far. And we talk about sericulture and silkworms. I tell them amazing facts, like caterpillars are not worms, and silk is caterpillar spit. And I know you guys, I think you've all passed oral exams, and you all know this stuff. But they're actually rather amazed. And we talk about things that they usually don't know about, and that is that silk has really unique mechanical properties. This is, again, one of these lectures where I have to go back and learn stuff that I don't know, such as what are these unusual mechanical properties. It has to do with tensile strength and the fact that silk is very lightweight yet very sturdy. It's also used in biomedical repair, and the military, like the DOD, is real interested in silk because of these mechanical properties. Sericulture. I tell them about Bombyx mori, and this is in red, this rearing, because if anybody knows an artificial diet that works, I don't have access to mulberry leaves. I'm ashamed to say, well, I'm embarrassed to say my PhD was partly on insect rearing and artificial diets, incorporating leaf material, and I couldn't get the artificial diets to work. So if anybody knows of a good one, let me know, even one that I can make up in the lab. Doesn't have to be commercially available. So that didn't work. I wanted them to rear silkworms. And then we talk about current world silk production. Okay, and then there's one more lecture. This is on cochineal, telling them a little bit about the taxonomy, only so they understand what taxonomy is and why it's meaningful, as Ken Jurgen told us, and their natural history of this insect. And this is another beautiful thing if you want to do interdisciplinary teaching. The historical significance of the cochineal is very, very rich. It starts off with pre-Columbian times in Central and South America, and then you can go into the colonial era. Cochineal was a very important player on a world scale in economics, and there are unbelievable monographs written on this from historians and books. There's a recent book written on it. Until Allen and Dyes came in and kind of cochineal then took a hit in the world economy. But nonetheless, Peru is still heavily involved in producing cochineal, and so we talk a little bit about that. And then I send them to the grocery store, not to see if the oranges are with toilet paper, and those of you who are here for Ken Jurgen's talk know what I'm talking about, but rather to have them try to find where cochineal is used currently. I give them a few hints, And then when they come back the following class period, they debrief and they tell me all the different products where they found cochineal, which, by the way, is also known as Carmen. Perfect. 5 minutes. Okay. And here you see some of the results of their work. Up in the first panel there, you have students grinding the cochineal insects, again reminding you that if you do this, you should have some gloves for the students in case they have an allergy. You see students boiling the scarves in the dye bath, and then the results of their products. And you notice that Joe and Amanda down in the right-hand corner, by the way, Amanda's a voice major, very successful and about to graduate. You can see the different colors and hues that were achieved by using these different mordants and the dye baths. So now, here we are. I hope you were all paying attention. I gave you 25 minutes of nothing but passive, activity. You're asleep, you're tired, you're probably hungry. So what a great place to be in for me as the teacher. What I'm going to ask you to do now is think about the generative learning model. You guys can come in. You can sit down if you'd like, or not, if you don't want to. I'm pretty easy with my students. Think about the generative learning model. I have them, the numbers 1 through 6 that come from that handout of Martha and also of me, where I stole it from Martha's handout, and see how well we did. And I'm going to remind you now, we're going to make connections between learning theory and teaching strategies in particular to achieve these goals. And think about the Silk Road activities that we talked about, where we looked at the lecture that I gave them on the Silk Road, the Web of Knowledge, etc. And my email will come up here in a minute if you need to contact me. I can give you protocols for doing these other things I talked about, and I'd be happy to do so. So, questions, or can you make these connections? And I started you off on my handout, I think, but I don't remember what I put down. Okay, so I had, what did I have? Class. Bueller, what? The lecture on cochineal. Thank you. So what did I do? I left it open as to what I was doing on the teaching strategy. What do you think I did? So I gave them a lecture on cochineal. I had them go to the grocery store. What was I doing there? I was hoping for candy. I was hoping they would find it in candy and bring it in and we could eat it. But other than that, connecting new information. Yeah, they didn't know. Your students will be amazed when you tell them that they're eating insects in the form of dye in Mike and Ike, I think, and yogurt. Certain yogurts, Yoplait, has carmine or cochineal. And there's actually a movement where people are talking about wanting this to be disclosed because there are people that have allergies, like to peanuts. Other stuff? They're awfully, I think I put them to sleep.
No, I think they're still learning.
Okay.
The dyeing definitely ties in with practicing associated skills.
Yes, thank you. And that's a great one. They can do tie-dye. I had somebody happen to be visiting who was a textile expert and came in and showed them how to do those beautiful tie-dyes. I guess in the 60s I didn't develop the skills that this person had, so they did some beautiful things. Other things or questions? It's all clear? Yes.
How expensive is the silk dyeing?
Good question. Yeah, because none of us have any money for labs. The most expensive thing is the cochineal. And if you wish, I'd be happy to send you the recipes for the dye baths. We did do a lot of empirical work on this to try to get it to where we were using what we needed to get it to dye. The other reason I used mordants, I fell into that. So let me back that up. So that little package of cochineal that you saw, and I can tell you where that comes from. It's from a company in Vancouver, BC. That's about $45, but it goes a long way. Aside from that, the silk scarves are really inexpensive. They're about a dollar or a little more. And I can, again, those that goes come from Dharma. I can give you that information. They're white. The reason I went to mordants was I couldn't get the silk, the cochineal to take to the silk. I admit that I hadn't done an important thing, which was wash out the sizing, but I don't think it would have held as well. So if you use a mordant and it actually changes the fiber, as I understand it from textile experts, then when you come in with the cochineal, it binds very strongly to the dye and it becomes color fast, if any of you are people that seamstresses, former seamstresses know this, what color fast means. It doesn't bleed when you throw it in the wash. And you also use something called Synthrapol that you wash the scarf with before and then after you're all done. So we're done?
Yeah.
Speaking of done, thanks. And thanks, Martha.
And efficacy of coccinellids as biocontrol agents in these fields. For example, there's a well-known example of cotton fields where nectarless cotton, cotton without an extraflora nectary, you see lower abundances of the coccinellids in those fields. Although it's not always a good thing to have the extrafloral nectary, there's a recent study from 2006 where they looked at the presence of added extrafloral nectaries to apple trees, bound them onto the twigs, and actually got reduced predation by Harmonia oxyridis on apple aphids because they were too busy eating the nectar. Another way that ladybugs can connect with their plants is through the prey in sort of a classic tritrophic way. If there's resistance characteristics in the cultivar, some secondary chemicals that are providing toxicity that is impacting their prey, that can negatively affect the coccinellids both by a direct toxic effect if there's a secondary chemical moving up through the system, and also because there's a reduced abundance of prey, so that's going to impact their levels. There's also some examples of positive impacts. Cotton cultivars with a higher levels of gossypyl produce aphids that have a higher fatty acid content, which are a better food for the predators, and so you get the coccinellids having a longer or a shorter development time and a larger weight when they are mature. Another hot topic lately is the impact of Bt in genetically engineered crops and corn and potatoes and various other crops, that people have looked at whether or not the Bt in the plants is impacting the coccinellids, and that's both directly by looking at how whether or not pollen feeding by the coccinellids on Bt pollen is affecting the coccinellids, and through the prey, and whether or not Bt toxins are being taken up by the prey, and then subsequently are taken up by the coccinellids, and furthermore, whether or not that affects them. And there's been some sort of contradictory results on that. I don't think the jury is in quite yet, but sort of what the gross level seems to be that it doesn't have too much impact on the life cycle, but there does seem to be some movement up through the trophic chain of the Bt toxins. But as I say, that's the gross oversimplified level. And then another way that they might connect to their plants is plants as signals. And there's an interesting study on rice where they looked at the variation between cultivars in the volatile profiles of rice cultivars that had been damaged by plant hoppers, and the variation in that volatile profiles led to a variation in the number of predators that were responding. So some rice cultivars were better recruiters of predators when they'd been damaged, and that included a differential response of the ladybugs. So there was a difference in how well the ladybugs were responding to those plants. Okay. Well, my major focus in this talk is going to be looking at how ladybugs connect with plants as a foraging substrate. Ladybugs, for the most part, are looking for their food on the plant. So the surface of the plant and the shape of the plant, both the macro aspects of the plant and the micro aspects of the plants, the surface, the hairs, and the wax, are going to impact how the predators are able to find their prey and eat them. Just one example, elegant example of how leaf architecture and plant architecture can impact predator efficiency was a study, LeGrand and Barbosa. They used different morphotypes of peas, pea leaves, that went from a normal leaflet to one that had the tendrils expanded into bigger leaflets to one that was an aphylla, where all of the leaflets were changed into leaflets. And as you can see, the morphological complexity of the plant is greatly increased on the tendrils as compared to the non-tendrilled morphotype. And the ladybugs were less effective, C7s were less effective predators on the more complex plants, and it seemed to be an effect of the higher branching ratio. It was harder to cover the whole plant. It was more finely dissected, and this really showed that the architecture can impact how they find their prey. On a smaller level, looking at the surface of the plant can also really affect how the ladybugs are able to move around. This is a study from Shaw from 1982, looking at Adelia bipunctata on plant surfaces, and he looked at a range of plants, and this is a graph of foraging behavior over a 3-hour period and showing the proportion of time they spent in each in the areas, different areas that they searched, and also some of the other behaviors. Looking at plants that were smooth, slippery with a lot of wax, kohlrabi, rough, that had matted hairs, the apple, sparse hairs, really hairy, tomatoes with lots of trichomes, and hooked hairs on the bush beans. And you can see, for example, on the hooked hairs of the bush beans, so the big black bar, they spent most of their time trapped. They were not very good aphid predators because they were stuck. On the tomato plant, that pink part is they weren't on the plant for most of the time they were there, and they didn't actually capture any aphids. On the kohlrabi, which was slippery and waxy, they spent most of their time walking around on the stem. They couldn't really access the leaf edge, the green part, or the leaf blade. And they spent most of their time in the stripy part, which is non-productive behavior. So they spent most of their time slipping around, grooming, and otherwise not looking for prey. So really, they were able to locate and search effectively on the plants that had the sparse hairs or were smooth or had a good texture to them. So that the surface of the plant really impacted the ability of them to find their prey. And I'm going to be talking about this type of effect in a system that we all know and love. This is the pea, our peas here. This is the mutation that the tendrils are all extended to leaflets. And on the far side from me is the normal wax of the plant. And you can see it has a wax bloom on it. And on this side is a mutation. Well, and I'll be talking about this a little bit more on the next slide, where the wax is very much reduced. And these peas, of course, are fed on by pea aphids, and that's our prey. And the pea aphids are in turn fed upon by Hippodamia conversions. Now, to explain a little bit more about this wax mutation, the black pictures here are showing an SEM of the wax crystals on the surface. And on the normal wax plant with the wax bloom, you can see there's this crystalline wax structure. It's densely covering the plant. And what it creates is it's very difficult for the predators to effectively attach themselves to the plant. When they put their foot down, when they put their tarsus down on the plant, they're not really connecting to the plant.